a very general and very important problem which you find in a, you know, in a broad variety of systems, which is gonna be electrons in disorder potential. And so, and the picture we always learn about this problem is essentially classical, which is a Drudder picture. And so, and today we are gonna go further, and we are gonna study quantum effects in such a problem, and we'll see that it completely changes the picture and changes the nature of conduction and the nature of the electronic wave functions. And so, and we will approach this problem with from two different sides. So first, so we'll use two approaches. So first approach is gonna be using the Landauer formulae that we developed. And so, and on Monday we really rushed through it, so Landauer formalism. But so today we are gonna do it much more systematically, so hopefully it will make more sense. And so, and approach two is gonna be quite different. So in the approach two, we are gonna start with a system which is rather clean, and then we'll try to find the quantum corrections in the lowest order in disorder strength. So essentially it's gonna be perturbation theory. Theory in disorder strengths. So, but first let's very quickly review the Drude picture. So I won't go into much details because I guess you guys heard about it and you read about it before the course. So in the Drude picture, Drude theory, essentially electrons move like classical objects, so you can consider their motion as a random walk, right, with scattering of impurities, and the key quantities which tell you everything about transport are essentially the density of states at the Fermi level. Density of states, so because this quantity roughly tells you how many electrons can carry current and participate in diffusion and transport, and the diffusion coefficient. Diffusion coefficient. Right, so, and then you know that the Drude conductivity, we call it Drude, is given by simply E squared times nu times the diffusion coefficient, okay? And the diffusion coefficient, of course, you can express in terms of Fermi velocity and the mean free path, right? Which is set by the impurity concentration and their strength. So, as I said, this picture is essentially classical, right? And it also tells you that essentially the classical Ohm's law should hold. So for example, if I consider a system of size L, and so, and let me for simplicity today consider systems which have the same size in all direction, right, so which are cubes, then the resistance of the system goes as 1 over sigma system size 2 minus d, right, so where d is the dimensionality of space. So for example, if you're talking about two-dimensional systems, then the resistance per square is independent of size, right? So, or as we agreed in the first lecture, we will also consider conductance G, which is inverse of the resistance. So, in conductance is simply sigma L to the power d minus 2. So, this picture works very well in real system as long as you're thinking about relatively high temperatures. And so, and why is that important? So, this means, right, if you have high temperature, you have a lot of phonons and in general a lot of fluctuations in your system. Okay, and this thermal fluctuations suppress quantum mechanical effects, because essentially they you know, if you think about what is the main quantum mechanical effect, it is interference of different trajectories, right? And if you have strong thermal fluctuations, what happens essentially, depending on which trajectory you cover, you pick up different phase, and then all the interference terms average out to zero, right? So, and that's why you can treat electrons as classical objects, and this picture works very, very well. Now, turns out, however, that if you go to lower temperatures, then something very different happens. And so, and let me mention to you three experimental observations which really violate this Drude picture. Okay, and then by the end of the lecture or by the next lecture, we will understand all these observations in terms of quantum effects. So so let me just mention three experimental observations. So first experimental observation is that at low temperatures, and so this is all at low temperatures. At low temperatures when essentially you suppress fluctuations and increase coherence times, right? And then quantum effects become important. So first of all, the Ohm's law is violated. Violated. So if you look at the resistance of a system as a function of the system size L, you see that it decreases faster than this law would predict. And this effect is especially pronounced in one-dimensional and two-dimensional systems. Second observation is that the conductivity shows very unusual temperature dependence. Let me call it anomalous behavior of sigma of t. And so what do I mean by that? So in the conventional sort of classical theory of solids, right, you expect that okay, so what does Drude formula would tell you, what would it predict for the temperature dependence? So generally scattering of electrons is due to electron phonon interaction or electron electron interaction, right? And as you decrease temperature, there are fewer and fewer phonons, let's say, right? And fewer excited electronic states. So this tells you that the scattering becomes less and less likely, right? So mean free path goes up, conductivity goes up. Here at low temperatures, you see something very different. You see that at lower temperatures, conductivity starts decreasing with temperature. Right, so it goes down. So d sigma over dt is greater than zero, right? So which is against the prediction of classical theory. And the third observation is that if you apply magnetic field and study so-called magnetoresistance, which is just essentially the how conductivity changes as you apply magnetic field, you find that the conductivity is very sensitive to very weak values of magnetic field, which is again goes against classical intuition, because classically you could generalize the Drude formula by adding magnetic field, and then the relevant classical scale of magnetic field which would affect conductivity is such that essentially magnetic length should become comparable to the mean free path. So but what is observed is something very different. So you need much weaker field to change the conductivity. Okay, so this is quite surprising, let's try to understand it. So let's try to understand what quantum. Yeah.
There's a small question. So why do we have the Fermi velocity instead of an effective velocity in the coefficient?
What do you mean by effective velocity? Good question. So that's drift velocity is proportional to the electric field, right? So you see conductivity is essentially the kinetic coefficient which links the current to the electric field, right? And drift velocity is also proportional to the electric field, right? So you see that diffusion coefficient should not depend on electric field, right? So and of course it's natural, right, that if you have electrons, you know, it's natural that the diffusion coefficient would depend on the Fermi velocity because this is how fast they move, right? Consider it as a random walk. Consider it as a random walk with some velocity and some scattering probability, and then just from this consideration, you would derive this formula immediately. You know, and in general, the picture of drift velocity is really very very classical, right? It's a that's not how you should do it. In principle, you should consider distribution function of the electrons near the Fermi surface, right? And right, so let me just answer this question. So let's say this is your Fermi surface, right? And you have in the equilibrium, all the states inside Fermi surface are filled, right? And outside they're empty. And what electric field does, it essentially distorts this distribution function such that on average you're carrying some current, okay? So if you guys care, we can consider it later. So just, you know, let me know. So for now we won't need this because we will use a different set of tools. So let's start thinking about this problem with Landauer formalism. And we will consider the following model of disorder. Okay, so we are gonna consider one-dimensional conductor with a bunch of scatterers, right, or impurities, which are weak, right? So our model, it's essentially 1D conductor with randomly distributed potential barriers. okay? And every one of these barriers is described by some scattering matrix, right? So let's say 1, 2, i, n, right? So scattering matrix I is just, so it's just r i t i t i prime r i prime, right? So here you see that I wrote this matrix such that it obeys the time reversal invariance. So you remember we derived that in the previous lecture that it should be equal to its transposed, right? And this is the most general form which satisfies this. So let me consider a somewhat special model of disorder, which is gonna make our analysis simpler, but of course the conclusions would not depend on this particular choice of the model. So I will assume that essentially all the barriers are weak and have the same strength. Okay, barriers weak and have the same strength, so such that reflection probability, right, is much less than one, right? So these barriers are almost transmitting. There is very small amplitude for them to reflect your electron. And you can ask, where would disorder come in? So disorder would come in the distances between these barriers, okay? Because essentially, when an electron moves between two barriers, right, it picks up a phase which is equal to e to the I k r I plus one, where this is the distance between them, right? So let's say this would be r I plus one, right? So this gives you some quantum mechanical phase, right? And this phase is going to be random, so that's going to be my disorder. That's where the randomness is going to come in. Okay, so these phases are going to be random. Okay, so and our plan is essentially to find the resistance of such a conductor, averaged over different disorder realizations. Okay, so but first of all, we should agree on what is the resistance in this case. Okay, because in the previous lecture we were considering two-terminal conductance, which you measure if you have a single barrier and two leads, right? But now we want to ask something different. We want to ask about essentially voltage distribution in the wire, right? So turns out that you have to consider slightly different quantity. So let me spend 2 minutes on defining it. So proper resistance in this case. So what would it be? So let's consider it for a single barrier. Okay, so we have two leads and we have a single barrier, right? And we are in the source lead, we have some chemical potential mu s, and here we have some chemical potential mu drain, but for simplicity let me put it to zero, so that would not matter. So and I am passing some current, right? In the last lecture we derived that chemical potential for the electrons which are coming from the source lead is just mu s. Effective chemical potential for the reflected electrons is mu s times the reflection probability, right? And chemical potential for the transmitted electrons is just mu s times the transmission probability. Now, what I'm interested in is the voltage drop across this barrier, okay? Not the voltage drop across the whole thing, but the voltage drop across the barrier. So you'll see it's going to be slightly different, okay? And you'll understand why. So what do I need to do, right? I need to essentially measure I need to have some probe, right? Voltage probe, which comes here. And so VP for voltage probe, which comes and measures the local chemical potential in the wire on the two sides of the barrier. Okay, and you can formalize it so by saying that voltage probe should be a lead which is very, very weakly coupled with the wire, right? So there is very small probability for you to come from the wire and get transmitted to the voltage probe. So you can formalize it and use the multi-terminal Landauer formula that we derived, but you can also, in this case, you can also guess the answer, right? You can guess that, you know, chemical potential of the right and left going channels in this part of wire is different, right? And clearly the chemical potential that you would measure would be just the average of these two chemical potentials, okay? So you can, if you feel suspicious about this answer, please feel free to use the multi-terminal Landauer formula and derive it, right? But it is quite intuitive that what you would get, that the voltage you would measure would be just an average, right? So voltage V1 would be given by mu S plus mu SR over 2, and voltage V2 would be given by mu S times T over 2, okay? So the voltage drop would be just their difference, right? And that's given by mu S 1 plus R minus T over 2, okay? So, and this gives you, so remember that 1 minus T is R because probabilities must be conserved, so you get just mu S times R. Okay, and the current in this case is given by E squared over H mu S times T. So the proper resistance that we are used to would be just their ratio, now question is how we are gonna call this proper resistance in this case, because I've used all the R letters already. So let me pick a rather ugly notation, but at least it's going to be clear that this is different from those reflection probabilities. So let me call it G4 to the minus 1. So, and where this notation came from is essentially, so to measure such a resistance or conductance, I need four probes, right? I need two. Channels which would pass current and two voltage probes, right? That's why in total I need four to measure such a quantity, and resistance is the inverse conductance. So it's pretty ugly, but it's clear what it means. So in this case, it's going to be just H over E squared R over T. Okay, so and this is the quantity we are going to study in our problem with disorder. Okay, so and you may ask why is this answer different from the two terminal conductance that we derived? And this is essentially because, you know, this lead is not in equilibrium with this part of wire, right? Because the electrons which are going to the left, right, they come from somewhere else. So it's natural that the chemical potential here would be different from the chemical potential here, because they're not, it's an out of equilibrium problem, right? So it's not such a big surprise. So now let's go back to our problem and let's see how several barriers add up, right? So what kind of resistance they give rise to. And let's start with the simplest problem of two barriers, okay? So we're gonna consider problem of just two barriers, okay? And let's say scattering matrices of this are given by S1 and S2, and our goal is to find the combined scattering matrix. So how would we do that? So Okay, so let's just send a wave, right? With which is just a plane wave, and then we know that it has some probability to get transmitted, right? So with some amplitude B, it has some probability to get reflected with some amplitude A, right, and so on. So and then on this side I can only get transmitted. There is no way for me to get reflected. Now, of course, at each barrier I can find the relations between different coefficients, right, using scattering matrix. So I would get on the left barrier, I'll get the relation that A should be equal to, right, it could be reflected from this wave, so R1, right, plus, or it could be transmitted from this wave, plus CT1. So same thing, same story with B, right, so it could come from, could get transmitted or get reflected from this guy, and then I can do the same on the second barrier. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that when I'm traveling here, right, I pick up an extra phase, right, because there is some distance between these barriers. So I pick up some quantum mechanical phase phi, right, such that when I write the relations at this barrier, this phase would enter. Okay, so in here R1, R2 are reflection and transmission amplitudes of these scattering matrices, and okay, so for example in this one I got the phase minus phi, right, because I need to propagate this wave backwards, right, and get that's why I got the phase minus phi. So I can solve this, right, and then I can find the coefficient D, right, which is effectively it's nothing but the transmission amplitude for these two barriers combined, right, in the same way. Yeah. Uh-huh. You do, of course you do consider, right, because you see so all I used, right, is that this barrier is described by the scattering matrix, and so is this barrier, right? Now, bouncing back would be included. So if you would find, let's say, quasi bound states from the formula that we'll see, right? So so what you would get for the transmission would be to the I phi T1 T2, right? 1 minus e to the 2 I phi R1 R2. Right? So the bound states here would be sitting in this denominator, right? So if there is, right? Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's all right. It's all taken care of, right? Because C can get reflected, right? And all this multiple reflection process are taken into account, right? Because you see, the whole thing is self-consistent, right? Because on this barrier, I wrote that B can get reflected into C, right? So here it is. Right. So it's all taken care of, yeah. So, okay. So this is what I needed, right? And now I can go ahead and find my proper resistance for the two barriers. Okay. So, resistance would be given by G4 to the minus 1, as we agreed, h over e squared, absolute value of, so of the reflection, so which is A squared over D squared. And then if I do the simple math, what I would find would be the following answer. Okay, so where R1 and R2 are the reflection coefficients for the two barriers. So now let's compare it with the classical Ohm's law, right? So classical Ohm's law would tell me that the two classical resistors you should just add the resistances, right? So it would tell you that G minus 4 classical would be given by H over E squared. And so you know that resistance is just a reflection over transmission, so I can write it in the following form. Okay? So you see that the quantum answer is different, and different in two main ways, right? So first of all, quantum answer depends on disorder realization, right? You see that the random phase enters here, right? So depending on the disorder realization, I would end up with different resistances, right? So, and this is generally called mesoscopic fluctuations, this kind of phenomenon. Right, so it depends on disorder realization. But even more interesting effect is that if I average over disorder realizations, right, what I need to do is just forget about this angle because it's random, so cosine would average to zero, right? So quantum mechanical average over disorder realizations would be given by, so let me denote it by such brackets. So it's going to be H over E squared, 1 plus R1, R2, 1 minus R1, 1 minus R2. And you see that this is given by the classical term, right? Plus R1, R2, right, so it's takes the following form. So did I mess up somewhere? So let's see. Okay, guys, I think I messed up here. So 1 plus R2, like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is correct now. Right. So like that, right? So you see that on average, right, quantum mechanical interference makes your resistance larger, right, than classical. So this is quite, you know, quite an unexpected effect, I would say. So now we are prepared to add many resistors, right, and see how the average changes as the system size grows. Okay, so and let's just use this this idea of adding two. So let's say, okay, we've already added n, and they're described by some average resistance, and let's add one more, right? So we'll use essentially induction, right? So let's assume that we found average resistance for n little resistors, right? And now let's find next one. What happens if you add one more? So then I can simply use this formula that I derived, right? And by doing some simple math, you find the following. So you find that the average resistance of n plus one little resistors is given by average resistance of n ones, okay, plus, so plus resistance of the little resistor plus h over r squared. Okay, so this you get just by repeating what I was doing here, but you know, saying that R1 over T1 is given by this. Okay, so this is, I skipped this math. So but now I can write this now I can write this answer in terms of, you know, you could say RG type equation. So I could write that D G over D system size, right, is given by R times this. Okay, so I'm gonna see how the conductance or resistance flows as I increase the system size. Now this formula, you can see that, okay, remember that in this formula I've assumed that R is much less than one, which means that the resistors are small. Okay, so in this formula you can see there are different regimes, right? So if the resistance of the system is still small compared to this, right? So different regimes. So regime one is when G 4 to minus 1 n is much less than h over squared, much less than the conductance, than the resistance quantum. Okay, in this case, you know, I'll get that just only this term matters, right? So G 4 minus 1 to n is roughly R times h over squared times n, right? So this is roughly the Ohm's law. But you see that there would be critical value of n, right, when this term would become of order 1, right? So critical value would be essentially 1 over R. So, and then this term would start dominating, okay? And I can forget about this term and my resistance is gonna grow exponentially. Okay, so I want to stay on this blackboard, so let me erase this. So you see that when n is less than n star, right, you have the Ohm's law, right? But when it becomes greater than n star, your resistance really starts growing exponentially. Okay, so this is, you know, this is quite a surprising result, right? So it tells you that, okay, if you measure the resistance of a disordered one-dimensional conductor as a function of the system size, and this size, in this problem, n is effectively my system size, right? Because it's the number of impurities. You'll see that, okay, at first it goes as expected, Ohm's law, but once it becomes of order h over r squared, it really goes insulating. It really does not conduct anymore, right? So okay, classical result, of course, would be just it would keep going straight, right? So it tells you, so where did it come from? Essentially, this is because scattering on different barriers, right? Electron waves can interfere, right? And what this analysis tells you is that they interfere constructively, right? That the probability of reflection keeps growing. Okay, and also notice that we started from very weak disorder, right? So this result is quite strong. So it tells you that no matter how weak your disorder is in one-dimensional system, quantum interference becomes so strong that at some point you essentially cannot conduct anymore, right? And if you think what this means in terms of the electronic wave function, right? Usually you think about electrons as some, you know, propagating waves. Maybe they can scatter, right? But they're roughly plane waves, right? Or some linear superpositions of plane waves. But clearly in this region something very different must happen, right? So clearly electron wave functions are become localized on the scale, you know, in this case given by n star, right? So essentially all the wave functions have roughly the following form over n star, right? And okay, I should add some microscopic length scale, right? Some distance between impurities so that I keep the dimensions right. Right, so, in general, you see that this completely changes how you should think about the systems, right? So this, right, so this suggests that in one dimension, right, all there are no truly extended states. There are no truly conductors which are metallic, right? So in one dimension, if you make it big enough, it's gonna become insulating. Okay. So do you have any questions about this part? Yeah. So this tells you, you mean whether this result would help us resolve the first condition? Yes, of course, because you see the Ohm's, right? Ohm's law would be here. And here you see that its resistance is well above the Ohm's law. So it tells you that the conductivity you would measure would be well below the what Ohm's law would predict, right? It only violates when density is really high, when the size is,
oh, yeah.
When the size is large. Yeah. Yes. Of course, below, right? If the disorder is weak, of course, effectively on some small scale, it would appear metallic to you, right? The question is what happens later on, right? So And here, of course, here I consider zero temperature, right? So here I really, okay, I've solved the first problem, right? So it's clear that the quantum mechanical interference makes resistors non additive, right? But rather it grows faster, and at some point it really shoots up and really grows, become exponential. Right, and this signifies the onset of localization. Mm-hmm. You guys, any other questions about this part? Yeah, okay, so all clear. So then let's start talking about the second approach to this problem, which is essentially perturbative in disorder, right? And you'll see that the advantage of this analysis would be that it applies to, you know, you can develop such perturbation theory for in any number of dimensions. Okay, so we'll get some insight also into the behavior of two-dimensional and three-dimensional systems, but in the limit of weak disorder. So, but we'll just start it and then we'll continue in the next lecture. So, weak disorder. So let's essentially try to do the following. So let's say that, okay, so my system is almost classical, it's almost diffusive, but there is some weak quantum interference, right? So there is some small probability to interfere, and thinking about this is easiest when you view electrons as quasi-classical, right? And you consider, let's say you put electron in some point one, and you let it propagate, right? So it's a quasi-classical wave packet, right? So it can scatter off some impurity, go somewhere else, right? Go here and so on, right? So it performs some random walk, right? And there are many such trajectories. And I could go this way or I could go some other way, right? And if I wanted to take quantum mechanics into account, right, what I need to do is sum over different trajectories. Okay, so in general, the probability for the electron to get from point one to point two after time t, right, is just a sum, right, is just a sum over different trajectories. So let me call them trajectory I, right? And right, so it's essentially square of the sum of the amplitudes. Now you can break it down into two terms. First term would be classical, right, which is just the sum of probabilities, right? And then there would be the interference term. Okay, so now, of course, in the regime when quantum mechanical effects are weak, right, the first term is dominant, and that's what gives you diffusion. This term you would expect to be very, very weak and not important, right, because essentially it involves the phases of different trajectories I and j, and in general these phases would be random, so you expect that if you consider all trajectories, it would all average out to zero. This is almost true, but this argument misses the following fact. So it misses the fact that there are special classes of trajectories which have the same phase by time reversal invariance. Okay, so what are these? So let's say if I consider diffusion of an electron, right? So it can get from point one to point two, right? But it also has some probability to stay, right? And there are trajectories in which the electron comes back at some point, right? So let's say it goes this way. But of course, there is also time reversed partner of this trajectory, where I cover exactly the same trajectory, but I go in the opposite way, right? So I scatter off the same impurities, but backwards. And by the time reversal invariance, I know that time reversal partners should have the same phase. So, which means that in this sum they would interfere constructively, okay? And they would increase the probability that you stay where, essentially near where you started, okay? And so our next step would be to, you know, very, very qualitatively try to estimate the contribution of such trajectories. And you'll see that this could be important. So, but overall, right, philosophy is quite similar to what happened here, right? So waves backscatter, when waves backscatters, they can interfere constructively. Okay, and it's just we try to analyze it in different ways. So here we use Landauer formalism, and here we are gonna try to just estimate this from the quasi-classical picture. Okay, so first of all, when we think about the electron quasi-classically, right, in the leading order, it just diffuses. So after time t, right, so let's try to estimate the enhancement of the return probability. Right, so first of all, after time t, right? Electrons diffuse by distance, which is given by square root, effectively, d over t, right? So it goes as square root t for a random walk. So your electron at the end of the day, you it's essentially spread out in the volume, right, of the order of x to the d dt d over 2, right? So I won't worry about solving diffusion equation precisely, because I just need an estimate, so it will tell me everything I need to know. Now, effectively, right, since I consider electron as some quasi-classical wave packet, right, I should view it, you know, by uncertainty principle. You should think about the electron as some kind of tube, right, of the width of the order of lambda Fermi, right? Because this is really the only scale in my problem, Fermi wavelength. So and then as electron is moving during time delta t, it will cover volume, which is given by lambda Fermi d minus 1. It moves with velocity v Fermi times dt, right? This is the volume that electron covers. And I require that it comes back to where it started, right? So that there is such a trajectory which crosses itself, right, and which has a time reversal partner. Because this is right, trajectories which don't come back to itself do not have time reversal partner with the same phase. So what is probability of the electron crossing itself at time t? So okay, so all I need to do, I have this volume, and overall my electron is spread out in this volume, right? So the probability to return at time t, right, is just the ratio and of course if I return at any time, it would slow me down, right? So I need to integrate over time, right? So to find the total return probability, so delta p dt, let me call it, and delta p total, right, is given by the integral over time . So now there is the question, what should I take as limits in this integral, right? As the lowest limit, of course, I have to take the impurity scattering time, right? Because I cannot, you know, I start out, I cannot scatter and return before time tau, right? And as the upper limit, I should take either the time after which electron loses its phase coherence, or the system size, right? The largest size in the system. So let me call it tau max, right? Tau max. So it's going to be tau max is going to be larger of the phase breaking time. So let me call it tau phi, or the time you need to cover the whole system, which would be which would be square root. So let's see. L squared over d, right? So now, how should I view it? So let me view it like that. So you see that the quantum mechanical effects enhance the probability for electron to stay where it started, right? Now, on the other hand, I know that the probability of electron to stay near the where it started, right, classically, it would be just proportional to inverse over the inverse of the total volume that electron occupies after it diffuses. Right, so from this I can see that that the probability enhancement can be related to change in the diffusion coefficient. Okay, so I can write that return probability right, is enhanced return probability is roughly, right, it gives you relative change of the diffusion coefficient with a minus sign, right, because they're inversely related to each other. So now I can take this formula and find this quantum correction to the diffusion coefficient, right, which is also should also give me quantum correction to the conductivity. And of course the result of this integration, right, so we call delta d over d, which is equal to change in the conductivity, relative change in the conductivity. Result of this integration would depend on the dimensionality of space. So first of all, in one dimension, just taking this formula, I'll find that this correction is very large, right? So it goes like that, where L max, right, is either the scale on which you lose phase coherence or the system size, right? So you see that the conductivity, right, really drops due to quantum effects in one dimension, and this is what we saw within this Landauer approach. Now, in the two dimensions, you find that it also that the conductivity is suppressed, right, as a function of the log of the either system size or the phase breaking time. Oh, and the LD here is just the diffusion length scale, so it's just square root d scattering time, right? So it's very short scale. So you see that if you have very big system, right, in two dimension, this quantum correction also becomes very important, right? It becomes very large. And in three dimension, it's not so large. So it actually it gets less and less important as you increase your system size or phase coherence time. Okay, so you see from this you can already guess that the disorder has very different effect in different spatial dimensions. So it's super strong in 1D, it's strong but sort of on the border in 2D, and it's at least perturbatively it's not so important in 3D. Okay, so let's stop here because we are out of time. So and we will continue tomorrow. So do you guys have any questions about this part? Or is it all clear?
So what about the paths that are at a local extremum in the space?
Okay, yeah, good point. Would they be important, you mean? So in this case, you see there is no, because you're talking about diffusion, right? So there are naturally, I mean usually you have some path, right, which has extremum in the phase, right? That's usually important if there is one such path, right? And in diffusion there are many trajectories which can get you, right, which are roughly, you know, they have the same amplitude, right? So in this case, you know, if you have sure some of them might have an extremum in phase, but if you have many such paths, right, they would still interfere destructively overall with each other. Yes, we'll get there. Except strong disorder case is much harder, right? So. Yes, very good point. So this is actually important. So in the beginning, right, here I tricked you a little bit. So I said, okay, we are gonna develop perturbation theory in disorder. So, but I never said what is the small parameter, right? And the small parameter here is that essentially this correction must be much smaller than one, right? So which tells you that, you know, you start with conducting system and quantum mechanical correction is there, but it's small, such that, let's say, I can neglect trajectories which cross each other multiple times, right? Because there are fewer of those. So, for example, and let's actually look at it for the case of two spatial dimensions, right? And then you would find, if you just play with this formula, you find that this condition just means that the conductivity in units of E squared over H should be much greater than one, right? Or the conductance, right, in units of E squared over H should be much greater than one, right? Or the conductance, right, which is the same thing, should be much greater than one, right? But it tells you that in two dimensions this picture would always break down at some scale, right? Because at some point, if I take a big enough system, right, maybe exponentially large in the conductance, this would become of order one, right? And then of course this picture breaks down. Then you enter the regime of strong disorder. So yeah, this is a very good question. You guys, any more questions? Well, fractionalization. No. We, you know, fractionalization. You need electron interactions for fractionalization, right? So here, you see, this is intrinsically non-interacting problem, right? So I mean, it's still very difficult, right? But it's non-interacting. So here you have, you know, single electron propagating. There is no reason for it to fractionalize, right? So now you know to trigger your curiosity, I can tell you that this has been a very, very difficult problem for, you know, many decades, even for non-interacting electrons, and it's still, many aspects of it are still not solved, right? So but it's completely an open problem what happens if you have interacting electrons with disorder, right? So when there is localization, how it happens, what transport looks like, and so on. So, okay, guys, any more questions? Okay, if not, let's continue tomorrow.